equals a standardized food but does not comply with the standard, that food must be labeled as an imitation. Hard to argue with that. But the food industry did, strenuously for decades, and in 1973, it finally succeeded in getting the imitation rule tossed out. A little noticed but momentous step that helped propel America down the path to nutritionism. Industry hated the imitation rule. There had been such a tawdry history of adulterated foods and related forms of snake oil in American commerce that slapping the word imitation on a food product was the kiss of death, an admission of adulteration and inferiority. By the 1960s and 1970s, requiring that such a pejorative term appear on fake food packages stood in the way of innovation, indeed of the wholesale reformulation of the American food supply. A project that, in the wake of rising concerns about dietary fat and cholesterol, was coming to be seen as a good thing. What had been regarded as hucksterism and fraud in 1906 had begun to look like sound public health policy by 1973. The American Heart Association, eager to get Americans off saturated fats and onto vegetable oils, including hydrogenated vegetable oils, was actively encouraging the food industry to modify various foods to get the saturated fats and cholesterol out of them. And in the early 70s, the association urged that any existing and regulatory barriers to the marketing of such foods be removed. And so they were, in 1973, when the FDA, not, note, the Congress that wrote the law, simply repealed the 1938 rule concerning imitation foods. It buried the change in a set of new, seemingly consumer-friendly rules about nutrient labeling, so that news of the imitation rule's repeal did not appear until the 27th paragraph of the New York Times account, published under the headline, FDA Proposes Sweeping Change in Food Labeling. New rules designed to give consumers a better idea of nutritional value. The second deck of the headline gave away the game. Processors back move. The revised imitation rule held that as long as an imitation product was not nutritionally inferior to the natural food it sought to impersonate, as long as it had the same levels of recognized nutrients, the imitation could be marketed without using the dreaded word. With that, the regulatory door was thrown open to all manner of faked low-fat products. Fats in things like sour cream and yogurt could now be replaced with hydrogenated oils or guar gum or carrageenan. Bacon bits could be replaced with soy protein. The cream in whipped cream and coffee creamer could be replaced with cornstarch. And the yolks of liquefied eggs could be replaced with, well, whatever the food scientists could dream up, because the sky was now the limit. As long as the new fake foods were engineered to be nutritionally equivalent to the real article, they could no longer be considered fake. Of course, the operative nutritionist assumption here is that we know enough to determine nutritional equivalence, something that the checkered history of baby formula suggests has never been the case. Nutritionism had become the official ideology of the Food and Drug Administration. For all practical purposes, the government had redefined foods as nothing more than the sum of their recognized nutrients. Adulteration had been repositioned as food science. All it would take now was a push from McGovern's dietary goals for hundreds of traditional foods that everyone knows to begin their long retreat from the supermarket shelves and for our eating to become more scientific. Food Science's Golden Age. In the years following the 1977 Dietary Goals and the 1982 National Academy of Sciences report on diet and cancer, the food industry, armed with its regulatory absolution, set about re-engineering thousands of popular food products to contain more of the nutrients that science and government had deemed the good ones and fewer of the bad. A golden age for food science dawned. Hyphens sprouted like dandelions in the supermarket aisles. Low fat, no cholesterol, high fiber. Ingredients labels on formerly two or three ingredient foods, such as mayonnaise and bread and yogurt, ballooned with lengthy lists of new additives. What in a more benighted age would have been called adulterants. The year of eating oat bran, also known as 1988, served as a kind of coming-out party for the food scientists who succeeded in getting the material into nearly every processed food sold in America. Oat bran's moment on the dietary stage didn't last long, but the pattern now was set, and every few years since then, a new oat bran has taken its star turn under the marketing lights. Here come omega-3. You would not think that common food animals could themselves be rejiggered to fit nutritionist fashion, but in fact some of them could be and were, in response to the 1977 and 1982 dietary guidelines, as animal scientists figured out how to breed leaner pigs and select for leaner beef. With widespread lipophobia taking hold of the human population, countless cattle lost their marbling, and lean pork was repositioned as the new white meat. Tasteless and tough as running shoes, perhaps, but now even a pork chop could compete with chicken as a way for eaters to reduce saturated fat intake. In the years since then, egg producers figured out a clever way to redeem even the disreputable egg. By feeding flax seed to hens, they could elevate levels of omega-3 fatty acids in the yolks. Wanting to do the same thing for pork and beef fat, the animal scientists got to work genetically engineering omega-3 fatty acids into pigs and persuading cattle to lunch on flax seed in the hope of introducing the blessed fish fat where it had never gone before, in hot dogs and hamburgers. But these whole foods are the exceptions. The typical whole food has much more trouble competing under the rules of nutritionism, if only because something like a banana or an avocado can't quite as readily change its nutritional stripes. Though rest assured, the genetic engineers are hard at work on the problem. To date, at least, they can't put oat bran in a banana or omega-3s in a peach. So, depending on the reigning nutritional orthodoxy, the avocado might either be a high-fat food to be assiduously avoided, old think, or a food high in monounsaturated fat to be embraced, new think. The fate and supermarket sales of each whole food rises and falls with every change in the nutritional weather, while the processed foods simply get reformulated and differently supplemented. That's why when the Atkins storm hit the food industry in 2003, bread and pasta got a quick redesign, dialing back the carbs, boosting the proteins, while poor, unreconstructed potatoes and carrots were left out in the carbohydrate cold. The low-carb indignities visited on bread and pasta, two formerly traditional foods that everyone knows, would never have been possible had the imitation rule not been tossed out in 1973. Who would ever buy imitation spaghetti? But of course, that is precisely what low-carb pasta is. A handful of lucky whole foods have recently gotten the good nutrient marketing treatment. The antioxidants in the pomegranate, a fruit formerly more trouble to eat than it was worth, now protect against cancer and erectile dysfunction, apparently, and the omega-3 fatty acids in the formerly just fattening walnut ward off heart disease. A whole subcategory of nutritional science funded by industry and, according to one recent analysis, remarkably reliable in its ability to find a health benefit in whatever food it has been commissioned to study, has sprung up to give a nutritionist sheen and FDA-approved health claim to all sorts of foods, including some not ordinarily thought of as healthy. The Mars Corporation recently endowed a chair in chocolate science at the University of California at Davis, where research on the antioxidant properties of cacao is making breakthroughs. So it shouldn't be long before we see chocolate bars bearing FDA-approved health claims. When we do, nutritionism will surely have entered its Baroque phase. Fortunately for everyone playing this game, scientists can find an antioxidant in just about any plant-based food they choose to study. Yet as a general rule, it's a whole lot easier to slap a health claim on a box of sugary cereal than on a raw potato or a carrot, with the perverse result that the most healthful foods in the supermarket sit there quietly in the produce section, silent as stroke victims, while a few aisles over in cereal, the Cocoa Puffs and Lucky Charms are screaming their newfound whole grain goodness to the rafters. Watch out for those health claims. The melting of the lipid hypothesis. Nutritionism is good for the food business, but is it good for us? You might think that a national fixation on nutrients would lead to measurable improvements in public health. For that to happen, however, the underlying nutritional science and the policy recommendations, not to mention the journalism based on that science, would both have to be sound. This has seldom been the case. The most important such nutrition campaign has been the 30-year effort to reform the food supply and our eating habits in light of the lipid hypothesis. At the behest of government panels, nutrition scientists, and public health officials, we have dramatically changed the way we eat and the way we think about food in what stands as the biggest experiment in applied nutritionism in history. 30 years later, we have good reason to believe that putting the nutritionists in charge of the menu and the kitchen has not only ruined an untold number of meals, but also has done little for our health, except very possibly to make it worse. These are strong words, I know. Here are a couple more. What the Soviet Union was to the ideology of Marxism, the low-fat campaign is to the ideology of nutritionism. Its supreme test, and as now is coming clear, its most abject failure. You can argue, as some diehards will do, that the problem was one of faulty execution, or you can accept that the underlying tenets of the ideology contained the seeds of the eventual disaster. At this point, you're probably saying to yourself, hold on just a minute. Are you really saying that the whole low-fat deal was bogus? But my supermarket is still packed with low-fat this and no cholesterol that. My doctor is still on me about my cholesterol and telling me to switch to low-fat everything. I was flabbergasted at the news, too, because no one in charge, not in the government, not in the public health community, has dared to come out and announce, you know everything we've been telling you for the last 30 years about the links between dietary fat and heart disease, and fat and cancer, and fat and fat? Well, this just in, it now appears that none of it was true. We sincerely regret the error. No. The admissions of error have been muffled, and the mea culpas impossible to find. But read around in the recent scientific literature, and you will find a great many scientists beating a quiet retreat from the main tenets of the lipid hypothesis. Let me offer just one example, an article from a group of prominent nutrition scientists at the Harvard School of Public Health. In a recent review of the relevant research called Types of Dietary Fat and Risk of Coronary Heart Disease, a Critical Review, The authors proceed to calmly remove one by one just about every strut supporting the theory that dietary fat causes heart disease. Frank Hugh and his colleagues begin with a brief, uninflected summary of the lipophobic era that is noteworthy mostly for casting the episode in the historical past. During the past several decades, reduction in fat intake has been the main focus of national dietary recommendations. In the public's mind, the word dietary fat has become synonymous with obesity and heart disease, whereas the words low-fat and fat-free have been synonymous with heart health. We can only wonder how in the world such crazy ideas ever found their way into the public's mind. Surely not from anyone associated with the Harvard School of Public Health, I would hope. Well, as it turns out, the self-same group, in thrall to the lipid hypothesis, was recommending until the early 1990s, when the evidence about the dangers of trans fats could no longer be ignored, that people reduce their saturated fat intake by switching from butter to margarine. Though red flags about trans fats can be spotted as far back as 1956, when Ansel Keys, the father of the lipid hypothesis, suggested that rising consumption of hydrogenated vegetable oils might be responsible for the 20th century rise in coronary heart disease. But back to the critical review, which in its second paragraph drops this bombshell. It is now increasingly recognized that the low-fat campaign has been based on little scientific evidence and may have caused unintended health consequences. Say what? The article then goes on blandly to survey the crumbling foundations of the lipid hypothesis circa 2001. Only two studies have ever found a significant positive association between saturated fat intake and risk of CHD, coronary heart disease. Many more have failed to find an association. Only one study has ever found a significant inverse association between polyunsaturated fat intake and CHD. Let me translate. The amount of saturated fat in the diet probably has little or no bearing on the risk of heart disease, and evidence that increasing polyunsaturated fats in the diet will reduce risk is slim to nil. As for the dangers of dietary cholesterol, the review found a weak and non-significant positive association between dietary cholesterol and risk of CHD. Someone should tell the food processors, who continue to treat dietary cholesterol as a matter of life and death. Surprisingly, the authors wrote, there is little direct evidence linking higher egg consumption and increased risk of CHD. Surprising, because eggs are particularly high in cholesterol. By the end of the review, there is one strong association between a type of dietary fat and heart disease left standing, and it happens to be precisely the type of fat that the low-fat campaigners have spent the last 30 years encouraging us to consume more of. Trans fats. It turns out that higher intake of trans fat can contribute to increased risk of CHD through multiple mechanisms. To wit, it raises bad cholesterol and lowers good cholesterol, something not even the evil saturated fats can do. It increases triglycerides, a risk factor for CHD. It promotes inflammation and possibly thrombogenesis, clotting, and it may promote insulin resistance. Trans fat is really bad stuff, apparently, fully twice as bad as saturated fat in its impact on cholesterol ratios. If any of the authors of the critical review are conscious of the cosmic irony here, that the principal contribution of 30 years of official nutritional advice has been to replace a possibly mildly unhealthy fat in our diets with a demonstrably lethal one, they are not saying. The paper is not quite prepared to throw out the entire lipid hypothesis, but by the end, precious little of it is left standing. The authors conclude that while total levels of fat in the diet apparently have little bearing on the risk of heart disease, the ratio between types of fats does. Adding omega-3 fatty acids to the diet, that is, eating more of a certain kind of fat, substantially reduces coronary and total mortality in heart patients, and replacing saturated fats with polyunsaturated fats lowers blood cholesterol, which they accept as an important risk factor for CHD. Some researchers no longer do, pointing out that half the people who get heart attacks don't have elevated cholesterol levels, and about half the people with elevated cholesterol do not suffer from CHD. One other little grenade is dropped in the paper's conclusion. Although a major purported benefit of a low-fat diet is weight loss, a review of the literature failed to turn up any convincing evidence of this proposition. It did, however, find some evidence that replacing fats in the diet with carbohydrates, as official dietary advice has urged us to do since the 1970s, will lead to weight gain. I have dwelled on this paper because it fairly reflects the current thinking on the increasingly tenuous links between dietary fat and health. The lipid hypothesis is quietly melting away, but no one in the public health community or the government seems quite ready to publicly acknowledge it. For fear of what, exactly? That we'll binge on bacon double cheeseburgers? More likely that we'll come to the unavoidable conclusion that the emperors of nutrition have no clothes and never listen to them again. In fact, there have been dissenters to the lipid hypothesis all along. Lipid biochemists like Mary Enig, who has been sounding the alarm on trans fats since the 1970s, and nutritionists like Fred Comerow and John Yudkin, who have been sounding the alarm on refined carbohydrates also since the 1970s. But these critics have always had trouble getting a hearing, especially after 1977, when the McGovern guidelines effectively closed off debate on the lipid hypothesis. Scientific paradigms are never easy to challenge, even when they begin to crack under the weight of contradictory evidence. Few scientists ever look back to see where they and these paradigms might have gone astray. Rather, they're trained to keep moving forward, doing yet more science to add to the increments of our knowledge, patching up and preserving whatever of the current paradigm can be preserved until the next big idea comes along. So don't count on a scientific Alexander Solzhenitsyn to show up and expose the whole fat paradigm as a historical disaster. The closest thing to such a figure we have had is not a scientist, but a science journalist named Gary Taubes, who for the last decade has been blowing the whistle on the science behind the low-fat campaign. In a devastating series of articles and an important new book called Good Calories, Bad Calories, Taubes has pretty much exploded the whole lipid hypothesis, demonstrating just how little scientific backing it had from the very beginning. Indeed. Wind the tape back to 1976, and you find plenty of reasons to doubt the lipid hypothesis even then. Some of these reasons were circumstantial, but nevertheless compelling. For instance, during the decades of the 20th century, when rates of heart disease were rising in America, Americans were actually reducing their intake of animal fats in the form of lard and tallow. In place of those fats, they consumed substantially more vegetable oils, especially in the form of margarine, sales of which outpaced butter for the first time since 1957. Between the end of World War II and 1976, the year of McGovern's hearings, per capita consumption of animal fats from all sources dropped from 84 pounds to 71. While fats from seed oils approximately doubled. Americans appeared to be moving in the direction of a prudent diet, and yet, paradoxically, having more heart attacks on it, not fewer. In 1945, 217,000 deaths in the United States were attributed to heart attacks, By 1960, there were 500,000. By 2001, that number had fallen to 185,000. It's important to note that the diagnostic criteria for heart attack have changed over time, as has the size of the population. As for the precipitous decline in heart disease during the years of World War II, that could just as easily be attributed to factors other than the scarcity of meat, butter, and eggs. Not just animal protein, but sugar and gasoline were also strictly rationed during the war. Americans generally ate less of everything, including, notably, refined carbohydrates. They did, however, eat more fish, and got more exercise because they couldn't drive as freely because of rationed gas. But the lipid hypothesis would not be deterred. Researchers in the 1950s and 1960s had studied populations in other countries that had substantially lower rates of heart disease, which could be explained by their lower consumption of saturated fat. That it could just as easily be explained by other factors: fewer total calories, fewer refined carbohydrates, more exercise, more fruits and vegetables or fish, did not disturb the gathering consensus that fat must be the key. The consensus hinged on two suggestive links that researchers had established by the early 60s. A link between high rates of cholesterol in the blood and the likelihood of heart disease, and a link between saturated fat in the diet and cholesterol levels in the blood. Both these links have held up, but it doesn't necessarily follow from them that consumption of saturated fat leads to heart disease, unless you can also demonstrate that serum cholesterol is a cause of heart disease and not, say, just a symptom of it. And though evidence for a link between cholesterol in the diet and cholesterol in the blood has always been tenuous, the belief that the former contributed to the latter has persisted, perhaps because it made such intuitive sense, and perhaps because it was being so heavily promoted by the margarine makers. Despite these gaps, it seemed a short, easy step for McGovern's committee to link the links, as it were, and conclude that eating meat and dairy, as important sources of both saturated fat and cholesterol, contributed to heart disease. After all, the American Heart Association had already taken the same short linking step and had been advocating a prudent diet low in fat and cholesterol since 1961. Still, the committee was not unaware of the controversy surrounding the research on which it was basing its recommendations. It had received a strongly worded letter of dissent from the American Medical Association, arguing that there is a potential for harmful effects for a radical long-term dietary change as would occur through adoption of the proposed national goal. Nevertheless, the national goal was adopted. Never before had the government endeavored to change the diet of the whole population. In the past, nutritional policies had targeted particular populations at risk for particular deficiencies. But, as Taubes has documented, the attitude on the committee was that even if all the data weren't hard as rock quite yet, what would be the harm in getting Americans to cut down on dietary fats? At the press conference introducing the dietary goals, Mark Hegstead, the Harvard School of Public Health nutritionist who helped to shape them, put it this way: "The question to be asked is not why we should change our diet, but why not?" At least one good answer to that question was apparently overlooked. Perhaps because fat was in such bad repute in 1977, Dr. Hegstead and his colleagues must not have stopped to consider how a change in the levels or ratios of the various lipids and the promotion of a biologically novel fat like trans fat might affect human physiology. It bears remembering that the human brain is about 60% fat. Every neuron is sheathed in a protective layer of the stuff. Fats make up the structure of our cell walls, the ratios between the various kinds influencing the permeability of the cells to everything from glucose and hormones to microbes and toxins. Without adequate amounts of fat in the diet, fat-soluble vitamins like A and E can't pass through the intestinal walls. All this was known in 1977. But the Hippocratic Oath, first do no harm, evidently does not apply to official dietary advice, which at least in 1977 followed a very different principle. Why not? So potentially much was at stake for our health and well-being when the government threw its weight behind a wholesale change in the American diet. True, it was entirely possible that the nation would have chosen simply to ignore the dietary goals and go on eating as it had. But that's not what happened. Instead, the goals were taken seriously, and one of the more ambitious nutritional experiments in our history got underway. Authority over the American menu, which in the past had rested largely with tradition and habit, and mom, shifted perceptibly in January 1977. Culture ceded a large measure of its influence over how we ate and thought about eating to science. Or what passes for science in dietary matters? Nutritionism would be a more accurate term. Premature or not, the New York Times' Jane Brody wrote in 1981, the dietary goals are beginning to reshape the nutritional philosophy, if not yet the eating habits of most Americans. Eat right, get fatter. In fact, we did change our eating habits in the wake of the new guidelines, endeavoring to replace the evil fats at the top of the food pyramid with the good carbs spread out at the bottom. The whole of the industrial food supply was reformulated to reflect the new nutritional wisdom, giving us low-fat pork, low-fat snack wells, and all the low-fat pasta and high fructose, yet low-fat corn syrup we could consume, which turned out to be quite a lot. Oddly, Americans got really fat on their new low-fat diet. Indeed, many date the current epidemic of obesity and diabetes to the late 1970s, when Americans began binging on carbohydrates, ostensibly as a way to avoid the evils of fat. But the story is slightly more complicated than that. For while it is true that Americans post-1977 did shift the balance in their diets from fats to carbs so that fat as a percentage of total calories in the diet declined from 42% in 1977 to 34% in 1995, we never did in fact cut down on our total consumption of fat. We just ate more of other things. We did reduce our consumption of saturated fats, replacing them as directed with polyunsaturated fats and trans fats. Meat consumption actually held steady, though we did, again as instructed, shift from red meat to white to reduce our saturated fat intake. Basically, what we did was heap a bunch more carbs onto our plate, obscuring but by no means replacing the expanding chunk of now skinless white animal protein still sitting there in the middle. How did that happen? I would submit that the ideology of nutritionism deserves as much of the blame as the carbohydrates themselves do. That and human nature. By framing dietary advice in terms of good and bad nutrients, and by burying the recommendation that we should eat less of any particular actual food, it was easy for the take-home message of the 1977 and 1982 dietary guidelines to be simplified as follows. Eat more low-fat foods. And that is precisely what we did. We're always happy to receive a dispensation to eat more of something, with the possible exception of oat bran, and one of the things nutritionism reliably gives us is some such dispensation. Low-fat cookies then, low-carb beer now. It's hard to imagine the low-fat, high-carb craze taking off as it did, or our collective health deteriorating to the extent it has, if McGovern's original food-based recommendation had stood. Eat fewer meat and dairy products. For how do you get from that stark counsel to the idea that another carton of Snackwells is just what the doctor ordered? You begin to see how attractive nutritionism is for all parties concerned, consumers as well as producers, not to mention the nutrition scientists and journalists it renders indispensable. The ideology offers a respectable rationale for creating and marketing all manner of new processed foods and permission for people to eat them. Plus, every course correction in nutritionist advice gives reason to write new diet books and articles, manufacture a new line of products, and eat a whole bunch of even more healthy new food products. And if a product is healthy by design and official sanction, then eating lots of it must be healthy too. Maybe even more so. Nutritionism might be the best thing ever to happen to the food industry, which historically has labored under the limits to growth imposed by a population of eaters that isn't expanding nearly as fast as the food makers need it to if they are to satisfy the expectations of Wall Street. Nutritionism solves the problem of the fixed stomach, as it used to be called in the business. The fact that compared to other consumer products, demand for food has in the past been fairly inelastic. People could eat only so much, and because tradition and habit ruled their choices, they tended to eat the same old things. Not anymore. Not only does nutritionism favor ever more novel kinds of highly processed foods, which are by far the most profitable kind to make, it actually enlists the medical establishment and the government in the promotion of those products. Play your cards right and you can even get the American Heart Association to endorse your new breakfast cereal as heart healthy. As I write, the FDA has just signed off on a new health claim for Frito-Lay chips on the grounds that eating chips fried in polyunsaturated fats can help you reduce your consumption of saturated fats, thereby conferring blessings on your cardiovascular system. So can a notorious junk food pass through the needle of nutritionist logic and come out the other side looking like a health food. Beyond the pleasure principle. We eaters, alas, don't reap nearly as much benefit from nutritionism as food producers. Beyond providing a license to eat more of the latest approved food-like substance, which we surely do appreciate, nutritionism tends to foster a great deal of anxiety around the experience of shopping for food and eating it. To do it right, you've got to be up on the latest scientific research, study ever longer and more confusing ingredients labels, sift through increasingly dubious health claims, and then attempt to enjoy foods that have been engineered with many other objectives in view than simply tasting good. Jeffrey Cannon points out that nutrition labels, which have become the single most ubiquitous source of chemical information in our lives, are advertisements for the chemical principle of nutrition. To think of some of the most delicious components of foods as toxins, as nutritionism has taught us to do in the case of fat, does little for our happiness as eaters. Americans have embraced a nutritional philosophy, to borrow Jane Brody's words, that regardless of whether that philosophy does anything for our health, surely takes much of the pleasure out of eating. But why do we even need a nutritional philosophy in the first place? Perhaps because we Americans have always had a problem taking pleasure in eating. We certainly have gone to unusual lengths to avoid it. Harvey Levenstein, who has written two superb histories of American food culture, suggests that the sheer abundance of food in America has bred a vague indifference to food, manifested in a tendency to eat and run, rather than to dine and savor. To savor food, to conceive of a meal as an aesthetic experience, has been regarded as evidence of effeteness, a form of foreign foppery. Few things have been as likely to get an American political candidate in hot water as a taste for fine food, which Martin Van Buren discovered during his failed 1840 re-election campaign. Van Buren had brought a French chef to the White House, a blunder seized on by his opponent, William Henry Harrison, who made much of the fact that he subsisted on raw beef and salt. George H.W. Bush's predilection for pork rinds and Bill Clinton's for Big Macs were politically astute tastes to show off. It could well be, as Levenstein contends, that the sheer abundance of food in America has fostered a culture of careless, perfunctory eating. But it seems likely that our Puritan roots also impeded a sensual or aesthetic enjoyment of food. Like sex, the need to eat links us to the animals, and historically, a great deal of Protestant energy has gone into helping us keep all such animal appetites under strict control. To the Christian social reformers of the 19th century, the naked act of eating was little more than unavoidable, and was not to be considered a pleasure except with great discretion. I'm quoting from Laura Shapiro's Perfection Salad, which recounts the campaign of these domestic reformers to convince Americans, in the words of one, that eating is something more than animal indulgence, and that cooking has a nobler purpose than the gratification of appetite and the sense of taste. And what might that nobler purpose be? Sound nutrition and good sanitation. By elevating those scientific principles and disdaining the proof of the palate, Shapiro writes, they made it possible for American cooking to accept a flood of damaging innovations for years to come. Low-fat processed food products prominent among them. So scientific eating is an old and venerable tradition in America. Here's how Harvey Levenstein sums up the quasi-scientific beliefs that have shaped American attitudes toward food for more than a century. That taste is not a true guide to what should be eaten. That one should not simply eat what one enjoys. That the important components of foods cannot be seen or tasted, but are discernible only in scientific laboratories. And that experimental science has produced rules of nutrition which will prevent illness and encourage longevity. Levenstein is describing the main tenets of nutritionism. Perhaps the most notorious flowering of pseudo-scientific eating and proto-nutritionism came back in the early years of the 20th century, when John Harvey Kellogg and Horace Fletcher persuaded thousands of Americans to trade all pleasure in eating for health-promoting dietary regimens of truly breathtaking rigor and perversity. The two diet gurus were united in their contempt for animal protein, the consumption of which Dr. Kellogg, a Seventh-day Adventist who bore a striking resemblance to KFC's Colonel Sanders, firmly believed promoted both masturbation and the proliferation of toxic bacteria in the colon. During this, the first golden age of American food faddism, protein performed much the same role that fat would perform during the next. At Kellogg's Battle Creek Sanitarium, patients, who included John D. Rockefeller and Theodore Roosevelt, paid a small fortune to be subjected to such scientific practices as hourly yogurt enemas to undo the damage that protein supposedly wreaked on the colon, massive vibration and electrical stimulation of the abdomen, diets consisting of nothing but grapes, 10 to 14 pounds of them a day, and at every meal, Fletcherizing, the practice of chewing each bite of food approximately 100 times, often to the rousing accompaniment of special chewing songs. The theory was that thorough mastication would reduce protein intake. This seems certain, and thereby improve subjective and objective well-being. Horace Fletcher, a.k.a. the Great Masticator, had no scientific credentials whatsoever, But the example of his own extraordinary fitness. At 50, he could bound up and down the Washington Monument's 854 steps without pausing to catch his breath, while existing on a daily regimen of only 45 well-chewed grams of protein was all the proof his adherents needed. According to Levenstein, scientists seeking the secret of Fletcher's exemplary health scrupulously monitored his ingestions and excretions, noting with regard to the latter, as all observers did, the remarkable absence of odor. The brothers Henry and William James both became enthusiastic chewers. William James wrote of Fletcher that if his observations on diet, confirmed already on a limited scale, should prove true on a universal scale, it is impossible to overestimate their revolutionary import. Fletcher returned the favor, assuring the philosopher that Fletcherism was advancing the same cause as pragmatism. Whatever their biological efficacy, all these dietary exertions had the effect of removing eating from social life and pleasure from eating. Compulsive chewing, much less hourly enema breaks, is not exactly conducive to the pleasures of the table. Also, Fletcherizing would have forcibly drained food of the very last glimmer of flavor long before the 100th contraction of the jaw had been counted. Kellogg himself was outspoken in his hostility to the pleasures of eating. The decline of a nation commences when gourmandizing begins. If that is so, America had little reason to worry. America's early attraction to various forms of scientific eating may also have reflected discomfort about the way other people eat. The weird, messy, smelly, and mixed-up eating habits of immigrants. Americans were particularly disturbed by the way many immigrant groups mixed their foods in stews and such, in contrast to the Anglo-American practice of keeping foods separate on the plate. The culinary format anthropologist Mary Douglas calls 1A plus 2B. One chunk of animal protein plus two vegetables or starches. Perhaps the disdain for mixing foods reflected anxieties about other kinds of mixing. How a people eats is one of the most powerful ways they have to express and preserve their cultural identity, which is exactly what you don't want in a society dedicated to the ideal of Americanization. To make food choices more scientific is to empty them of their ethnic content and history. In theory, at least, nutritionism proposes a neutral, modernist, forward-looking, and potentially unifying answer to the question of what it might mean to eat like an American. It is also a way to moralize about other people's choices without seeming to. In this, nutritionism is a little like the American front lawn, an unobjectionable, if bland, way to pave over our differences and Americanize the landscape. Of course, in both cases, unity comes at the cost of aesthetic diversity and sensory pleasure, which may be precisely the point. The proof in the low-fat pudding. Whatever the sacrifice of pleasure, it would be made up for by better health. That, at least, has always been the promise of nutritionism. But it's difficult to conclude that scientific eating has contributed to our health to this point. As mentioned, the low-fat campaign coincided with a dramatic increase in the incidence of obesity and diabetes in America. You could blame this unfortunate fallout on us eaters for following the official advice to eat more low-fat food a little too avidly. This explanation suggests that the problem with the low-fat campaign has been in its execution, rather than in the theory behind it, and that a better, clearer public health message might have saved us from ourselves. But it is also possible that the advice itself, to replace fats in the diet with carbohydrates, was misguided. As the Hugh paper suggests, there is a growing body of evidence that shifting from fats to carbohydrates may lead to weight gain, as well as a host of other problems. This is counterintuitive because fats contain nearly twice as many calories as carbs. 9 per gram for fats as compared to 5 for either carbohydrates or protein. The theory is that refined carbohydrates interfere with insulin metabolism in ways that increase hunger and promote overeating and fat storage in the body. Call it the carbohydrate hypothesis. It's coming. Gary Taubes describes the developing carbohydrate hypothesis at great length in Good Calories, Bad Calories. According to the hypothesis, most of the damage to our health that has been attributed to fats for the past half century, heart disease, obesity, cancer, diabetes, and so on, should rightly be blamed on refined carbohydrates. But the healthy skepticism Taubes brought to the lipid hypothesis is nowhere in evidence when he writes about the carbohydrate hypothesis. Even if refined carbohydrates do represent a more serious threat to health than dietary fat, to dwell on any one nutrient to the exclusion of all others is to commit the same reductionist error that the lipophobes did. Indeed, Taubes is so single-minded in his demonization of the carbohydrate that he overlooks several other possible explanations for the deleterious effects of the Western diet, including deficiencies of omega-3s and micronutrients from plants. He also downplays the risks, to health as well as eating pleasure, of the high-protein Atkins diet that the carbohydrate hypothesis implies. As the title suggests, Good Calories, Bad Calories, valuable as it is, does not escape the traps of nutritionism. If this is true, then there is no escaping the conclusion that the dietary advice enshrined not only in the McGovern goals, but also in the National Academy of Sciences report, the dietary guidelines of the American Heart Association and the American Cancer Society, and the U.S. food pyramid bears direct responsibility for creating the public health crisis that now confronts us. Even if we accept the epidemic of obesity and diabetes as the unintended consequence of the war against dietary fat, collateral damage, you might say, what about the intended consequence of that campaign? The reduction of heart disease. Here is where the low-fat campaigners have chosen to make their last stand, pointing proudly to the fact that after peaking in the late 60s, deaths from heart disease fell dramatically in America, a 50% decline since 1969. Cholesterol levels have also fallen. Epidemiologist Walter C. Willett of the Harvard School of Public Health, a co-author of the Hugh paper, cites the increase in consumption of polyunsaturated fats as a major factor, if not the most important factor, in the decline in heart disease, observed in the 70s and 80s, and calls the campaign to replace saturated fats in the diet one of the great public health success stories of our time. And so it would appear to be. We reduced our saturated fat intake, our cholesterol levels fell, and many fewer people dropped dead of heart attacks. Whether the low-fat campaigners should take the credit for this achievement is doubtful, however. Reducing mortality from heart disease is not the same thing as reducing the incidence of heart disease, and there's reason to question whether underlying rates of heart disease have greatly changed in the last 30 years, as they should have if changes in diet were so important. A 10-year study of heart disease mortality published in the New England Journal of Medicine in 1998 strongly suggests that most of the decline in deaths from heart disease is due not to changes in lifestyle, such as diet, but to improvements in medical care, though cessation of smoking has been important. For while during the period under analysis, heart attack deaths declined substantially, hospital admissions for heart attack did not. Modern medicine is clearly saving more people suffering from heart disease, but it appears that we haven't had nearly as much success eliminating the disease itself. Bad science. To understand how nutrition science could have been so spectacularly wrong about dietary fat and health, it's important to understand that doing nutrition science isn't easy. In fact, it's a lot harder than most of the scientists who do it for a living realize, or at least are willing to admit. For one thing, the scientific tools at their disposal are in many ways ill-suited to the task of understanding systems as complex as food and diet. The assumptions of nutritionism, such as the idea that a food is not a system but rather the sum of its nutrient parts, pose another set of problems. We like to think of scientists as being free from ideological taint, but of course they are as much the product of their ideological environment as the rest of us. In the same way nutritionism can lead to a false consciousness in the mind of the eater, so too it can just as easily mislead the scientist. The problem starts with the nutrient. Most nutritional science involves studying one nutrient at a time, a seemingly unavoidable approach that even nutritionists who do it will tell you is deeply flawed. The problem with nutrient-by-nutrient nutrition science, points out Marion Nestle, a New York University nutritionist, is that it takes the nutrient out of the context of the food out of the context of diet, and the diet out of the context of lifestyle. If nutrition scientists know this, why do they do it anyway? Because a nutrient bias is built into the way science is done. Scientists study variables they can isolate. If they can't isolate a variable, they won't be able to tell whether its presence or absence is meaningful. Yet even the simplest food is a hopelessly complex thing to analyze, a virtual wilderness of chemical compounds, many of which exist in complex and dynamic relation to one another, and all of which together are in the process of changing from one state to another. So if you're a nutrition scientist, you do the only thing you can do, given the tools at your disposal. Break the thing down into its component parts and study those one by one, even if that means ignoring complex interactions and contexts and the fact that the whole may well be more than, or maybe just different from, the sum of its parts. This is what we mean by reductionist science. Scientific reductionism is an undeniably powerful tool, but it can mislead us too, especially when applied to something as complex on the one side as a food, and on the other, a human eater. It encourages us to take a simple, mechanistic view of that transaction. Put in this nutrient, get out that physiological result. People differ in important ways. We all know that lucky soul who can eat prodigious quantities of fattening food without ever gaining weight. Some populations can metabolize sugars better than others. Depending on your evolutionary heritage, you may or may not be able to digest the lactose in milk. Depending on your genetic makeup, reducing the saturated fat in your diet may or may not move your cholesterol numbers. The specific ecology of your intestines helps determine how efficiently you digest what you eat, so that the same 100 calories of food may yield more or less food energy depending on the proportion of firmicutes and bacteroids resident in your gut. In turn, that balance of bacterial species could owe to your genes or to something in your environment. So there is nothing very machine-like about the human eater, and to think of food as simply fuel is to completely misconstrue it. It's worth keeping in mind, too, that, curiously, the human digestive tract has roughly as many neurons as the spinal column. We're only just beginning to understand their purpose, but their existence suggests that much more is going on in digestion than simply the breaking down of foods into chemicals. Also, people don't eat nutrients. They eat foods, and foods can behave very differently from the nutrients they contain. Based on epidemiological comparisons of different populations, researchers have long believed that a diet containing lots of fruits and vegetables confers some protection against cancer. So naturally, they ask, what nutrient in those plant foods is responsible for that effect? One hypothesis is that the antioxidants in fresh produce, compounds like beta-carotene, lycopene, vitamin E, and so on, are the X factor. It makes good theoretical sense. These molecules, which plants produce to protect themselves from the highly reactive forms of oxygen they produce during photosynthesis, soak up the free radicals in our bodies, which can damage DNA and initiate cancers. At least that's how it seems to work in a test tube. Yet as soon as you remove these crucial molecules from the context of the whole foods they're found in, as we've done in creating antioxidants